Good morning. It is Sunday, November 13th, 2011. Continuing our Confronting Chosenness series. The past couple of weeks we were talking about the covenants, that God had with Israel. And today, since, that's been a recurring theme, it's important to discuss, given that the covenants, one plausible way of understanding why we are distinct is because of the covenants that we have with God, to what extent can these covenants be broken? Meaning, if we don't hold up our end of the bargain. You may recall that there were actually two covenants that we had. One was with Abraham, that seemed to be unconditional. And then you also had the covenant of, at Har Sinai, that had a lot more conditions attached to it. Meaning, with Avraham Avinu, there were, by conditions, I don't mean conditions of the contract. I mean, there were no expectations of Avraham to fulfill. It was just God giving away, chosenness for free. Whereas at Har Sinai and the others, there are actual expectations of mitzvot. Mm-hmm. Summarize for us again quickly, Leviticus 26, source number 1.
But if you will not hearken unto me and will not do all these commandments, and if you shall despise my statutes or your soul abhor my judgments, so that you will not do all my commandments, but that you break my covenant, I will also do this unto you. I will even appoint over you terror, consumption, the burning ague that shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of the heart. You shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemy shall eat it. And I will set my face against you, and ye shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and ye shall flee when none pursueth you.
Yeah, and take from Deuteronomy 28, please, source number 2 on the list, verses 15 and 16.
Which will come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and the statutes of which I command you this day, that all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shalt thou be in the city, and cursed shalt thou be in the field.
And then it goes on at great length. So as you may recall, the first one, source on our sheet from Vayikra 26:14-17, refers to the breed at Har Sinai. Interesting, it uses the idiom lahafrechem et briti, should mean to, maybe not just violent, but actually to break the covenant. Mm-hmm. But what do you see is missing in these two sources? Devarim 28 was from that secondary covenant that Moshe did with the Jewish people before they entered the land of Israel. What do you see that is missing from both of these two statements?
Any humanity and kindness?
Well, the kindness is elsewhere. Here's what happens if you do. We're focusing now on the breaking the covenant part.
Are you looking? Are you asking? About maybe the more specifics as to what commandments should be kept, or maybe
not so much what commands should be kept, about the consequences.
Uh-huh.
See, here's the point. Normally, if you have a contract and you break a contract, you have breach a contract. I mean, the lawyer people are listening. What's still valid and what's still not. The way the contract or the covenant with God is set up, based at least on the Torah part, is if you break the covenant, by break the covenant meaning if you do not hold up your end of the deal, you don't find a source that the covenant becomes undone. Even it uses that term mahafrechem et briti, it seems to be one-sided, but the clause is God will rain down punishments on you,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to saying, if you sin, the covenant is now nullified.
Uh-huh.
And that's a very important distinction.
You can't get out of the contract.
It exactly.
It's broken.
That's the question that we're going to explore here. What does it really mean to break the covenant? Because you could argue, normally it's here are the terms. If you don't fulfill your terms, the covenant is nullified. Another way of saying, here are the terms and here are the consequences for certain actions. Right? In which case, even if we, don't keep the mitzvot, the idiom of breaking the covenant may or may not apply as much as, here are the
punishments.
Not just the punishments, but here are the contractually defined consequences of your actions.
The damages.
That's a good way of putting it. Ah, thank you. So you could say, well, here are the damages which you owe, in which case you haven't really broken the contract, but rather the terms are such where if this, then this, if something else, then something else.
Yeah.
Even though the idiom seems to be, we have to continuously keep it, which is why you've got that idiom of l'chofrechem et briti, is a little bit strange in terms of how we today might normally view contracts, because you could say, well, meeting out the punishment isn't breaking it, it's just, you know, here's what you're, you know, was supposed to happen. And we're going to see how this plays out in the books of the Nevi'im. One thing about the books of the Nevi'im, you know, I don't distinguish so much here chronologically, in terms of, you know, which Navi came first. Whereas, you know, we may do that a little bit more when we get to the rabbinic period, largely because the speaker in the prophets is still going to be God, which means, you know, we can assume that, you know, God being eternal, you're not going to have, you're not going to assume, you know, cultural relativism as much as if you have, you know, a man or different rabbis responding that, substantively differently at different times. We can assume, I think, a certain degree of consistency from God, at least in terms of these such questions.
It's a big assumption, because each prophet who claims to be a prophet of God may be a con man.
In theory, that was...
How do we know the difference?
Well, there's a certain degree of faith that you need with that, too. Meaning, yeah, you did have, you know, the Torah even writes about a Navi Sheker. And that's a whole other, you know, topic about how do you know who is a, who are the prophets, you know, who are the legitimate prophets and who are not. But we're going to assume a traditional approach here in the books that we have called Nevi'im, that what is represented here is in fact the Word of God in some form. So in section 2, we have a bunch of sources talking about God's anger towards the Jewish people. I think almost all of them, yeah, in this section I happen to be very Jeremiah, very Yirmiyahu heavy, which is kind of important because Yirmiyahu was the prophet that lived at the time of the destruction of the temple. So, you know, if anyone was going to really rail against, you know, speak about God's anger against the Jewish people, it was going to be Yirmiyahu. So it's a good test case at all. At any rate, Yirmiyahu, from chapter 2. You will be punished because you have sinned. You will be corrected for turning away from me, I am the Lord your God. If you desert me, bad things will happen to you. If you do not respect me, you will suffer bitterly. Here we have, you know, a certain degree of conditions here of...
It's the same thing that was said before. It's kind of repetitious.
Well, yes. Because you are, if you're trying to correct people's behavior, sometimes people need to be reminded of the consequences before they actually come to fruition. Then it says here, long ago you broke off the yoke I put on you. You tore off the ropes I tied you with. You said, I won't serve you. In fact, at every high hill you lay down like a prostitute. You worshipped other gods under every green tree. Now, in this verse of Olam Shavarti Ulayach shows that the transgressions of the Jewish people at least happened a long time ago. You made the conscious decision, to violate, to say that you're not actually either Lo Evod or Lo, there seems to be a creating C here, but, you know, you made a conscious decision that you're not going to follow. Sure. That you're not actually going to follow follow God, right? So, you know, because of that, you know, God is going to now start punishing you. The perception is, though, well, we've turned away from God at this point. You know, all right, take number source 4. This is Jeremiah 3, verse 1.
Supposing a man divorces his wife, what if she then gets married to another man? Should her first husband return to her again? If he does, won't the land become completely unclean? People of Israel, you have lived like a prostitute. You have loved many other gods. So do you think you can return to me now, announces the Lord? Look up at the bare hilltops. Is there any place where you have not committed adultery with other gods? By the side of the road, you sat waiting for lovers. You sat there like someone who wanders in the desert. You have polluted the land. You are like a sinful prostitute. So I have held the showers back. I have kept the spring rains from falling. but you still have the bold face of a prostitute. You refuse to blush with shame. You have just now called out to me. You said, my father, you have been my friend ever since I was young. Will you always be angry with me? Will your anger continue forever? That is how you talk, but you do all the evil things you can.
So there seems to be here, you know, a complaint against the disconnect of the Jewish people. On one hand, you know, they try to say that, hey, you know, isn't everything okay, everything cool? At the same time, the idiom here is, you know, basically, you know, cheating on God, you know, our spouse, and, you know, this relationship with other gods. Recurring problem, you know, in the time of Yirmiyahu. Yeah, and it seems that by us doing that, we have, you know, thus broken the covenant. You want to take source number 5 and Yirmiyahu 5, 18 and 19?
Me?
Yeah.
In spite of that, even in those days, I will not destroy you completely, announces the Lord. Jeremiah, the people will ask, why has the Lord our God done all of this to us? And then you will tell them, you have deserted the Lord, you have served other gods in your own land, so now you will serve another nation in a land that is not your own.
And the Lashon here isn't just so much that you sinned, right? Because there are a myriad of ways of sinning. I mean, the Torah is full of a whole lot of things that you shouldn't do. But by worshiping other gods, the language used here is Ka'asher azavtem oti, that you have actually left me. And notice that, you know, one of the main things I'm trying to get across here isn't just so much how you sinned or that you are unjust, but these are all idioms that Yirmiyahu is using to indicate not just that the Jews, you know, broke the covenant in terms of, you know, didn't keep certain mitzvot, but they're actually turning away from God and doing a more rejection of God in the present tense. Do you take number 6, please? Yirmiyahu, this is 15:6.
You have said no to me, announces the Lord. You keep on turning away from me, so I will destroy you with my own hands. I can't show you my tender love anymore.
Yeah. So it seems, again, because you turned away from God, God now turns away from you. In chapter 16, you tell these people all those things. They will ask you, why has the Lord decided to send us so much trouble on us? We haven't done anything wrong. We haven't committed any sins against the Lord our God. So there's a certain degree of, even though you're turning away from God, a certain obliviousness to it. We're not doing anything wrong. When they see that, tell them, I did it because your people have long ago deserted me. Now, says the Lord, they followed other gods. They served them in worship. Them, they deserted me, they did not obey my law. Right? And the root in the Hebrew comes up again of azavu. It's not just you are, you know, not keeping the terms of the covenant, but you're actually leaving God. And in source number 8 here, Yirmiyahu 22, people from many nations will pass by the city. They will ask one another, why has the Lord done such a thing to the great city? In the Hebrew, Va'amaru al asher azavu et brit Hashem Elokeichem, because the people have turned away from the covenant that the Lord their God made with them. And you'll find variants of this theme, you know, throughout all Tanakh. I mean, this is just focusing on Yirmiyahu, right? So we first had, you know, the covenants with God that we summarized briefly. We had, you know, the punishments, you know, that would be attached to it. And then we have the description, you know, often, and again, we can't go through all of Tanakh in this class, but at least throughout Yirmiyahu, the idiom is people are actually leaving God, right? Now, stop here for a second. In terms of chosenness, you could reasonably argue, well, that meant, well, you left God, therefore the covenant is over, right? And that's it. You know, you reject, like, it's not that God broke the covenant, you did. You turned your back from God. Therefore, you could theoretically argue, well, it shouldn't, you know, we're no longer God's chosen people anymore because we decided not to be chosen. But we'll see about, you know, a little bit, you know, more extrapolated in the, you know, upcoming sections. In source number 3, I've got one source from Yeshayahu 34 that I think is worth putting in here, which is, let's say the Jewish people did in fact break the covenant, right? And let's say hypothetically it was possible to do so. Could that mean then that there was another sort of chosen people? Ed, take number 30. This is Yeshayahu 34:1.
Nations, come near and listen to me. Pay attention to what I'm about to say. Nations, who is he talking to? Everybody.
Yep. Everyone.
Let the earth and everything in it listen. Let the world and everything that comes out of it pay attention. The Lord is angry with all of the nations. His anger burns against all of their enemies. He will totally destroy them. He will have them killed. Those who were killed won't be buried. Their dead bodies will be thrown on the ground.
Right. So if there is a rejection of the Jewish people, it's not that God found another nation to say, oh, we're going to pick you instead. Right. So an important thought to keep in mind. In the next section, I called it tough love because it's sort of, you know, gives a different approach. Well, I don't know. Jessica, it takes... it's fine. This is Yeshayahu 48:3-11.
Long ago, I told you ahead of time what would happen. I answered and made it known. And then all of a sudden they acted. And all those things took place. And you have severed you were, and your neck was as unbending as iron. Your forehead was hard as bronze. So I told you all of those things long ago before they happened. I announced them to you. I did it. I did it so they would be happen. I announced them to you. I did it so you would not be able to say, my statutes of God did them. My wooden and metal God made them happen. You have heard me tell you all of those things. Think about all of them. Won't you admit that they have taken place? From now on, I will tell you about new things that will happen. I have not made them known to you before. Those things that are taking place right now, they did not happen long ago. You have not heard of them before today, so you cannot say, oh yes, I already knew about them. You have not heard or understood what I said, and your ears have been plugged up for a long time. I knew very well that you would turn against me from the day you were born. You have refused to obey me. For the honor of my own name, I put off showing my anger and hold it back from you so people will continue to praise me. I do not want to destroy you. I have put you to the test in the furnace of suffering. I have tried to make you pure, but I did not use as much heat as it takes to make silver pure. I tried to purify you for my own honor. I did it for the honor of my name. How can I let myself be dishonored? I will not give up my glory to any other god.
Yeah. So it seems, before I tell you what I think, what's your sense from this passage?
What I'm wondering about is, what is the surrounding culture like? Are they beginning to recognize a single God? And or is it all what I worship? So at the time of Isaiah?
Oh, it seems that there was still other worship going on. I mean, there was still, you know, there were other, you know, cultures with deities, you know, going on there. But in terms of, you know, focus a bit on the actual, punishment here that, you know, prophesies that would be meted out in terms of our relationship with God. Why is God bringing down all the punishments?
Protect his own reputation.
Yeah. Well, it's...
I always had a trouble with being like, you messed up and I knew you, and now I'm angry.
From a parent, I don't know.
It's a very human expression.
That is right.
So I sort of expect more.
More from God? Well, in fairness, you know, the Tanakh is really big. And there are a lot of different idioms, and considering how often we've messed up in Tanakh, you'll find, you know, sort of variants on this theme. And there did seem to be a concern, even, you know, Joshua, when he made the covenant at the end of the book, he said, you know, oh, you know, you can't, you know, keep this up, and he uses a bit of reverse psychology. Even in as far as the Torah goes, there is that sense of, you know, this is going to be very difficult, you know, don't think you're going to do this, and bad stuff is going to happen, just be aware of it, you know, and this is coming.
Piles it on? Almost as hot as silver, and it just goes on and on and on.
Well.
And I get it.
And clearly it wasn't effective, though. Meaning, if the Jews actually was like, hey, wait, maybe we really ought to shape up, it didn't really work.
Right, this is not Nineveh, this is...
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a thought. There's one earlier prophet that we read today said, there's nothing up on the hill because you didn't worship me. You lay down like a prostitute with other gods. Any prophet from any god can make that statement and sound credible. Because there's no green on the hill.
Well,
so
like
a guy
said,
from Baal could say, you know, look, there's no green from the hill.
Well, like I said,
I'm the main man.
We're operating under the assumption that the prophets in Tanakh are in fact representing the will of God. That is an assumption. Take
big
it or leave
assumption.
It. Well, can't help you there.
I guess
yeah,
it's kind
sure.
of like you're reading Moby Dick. You have to pretend that Captain Ahab exists.
Or
you don't have to argue. There's no point in arguing about
it. Be dishonest. Is he above everything else?
You think so? I'll tell you. Here's another case where you know there is a concern. You know, going back to Sefer Shmot about ensuring that people know God's name. You know, Moses' argument against to God in terms of why not destroy you know the Jewish people after the Golden Calf says you know was it Pen Yomru let's you know the nation say. That Israel, because God couldn't bring them in. And it seems to be almost a play, well, you know, if you destroy the Jews in the desert, it's like, well, you weren't mighty enough to take them in. You know, these are all, I think those are great questions that we'll probably get to a bit in some ways in the, you know, Tuesday class in terms of, you know, God having honor, God worrying about his honor and reputation. Or alternatively, whether or not another way of, by means of explanation is, maybe it's not necessarily God so much worried about it himself as much as a way of expressing to the nation why the following is going to be necessary. And that's not an uncommon solution when you find anthropomorphisms or God being treated in human terms, not just in terms of physicality, but of also having what we might consider human emotions. That, you know, some will actually interpret this to say, God, these are all metaphors, and they're metaphors that are necessary so that we could comprehend what's going on.
But if God created man in his image, he knows how he's going to behave.
Now, yeah. Well, that was, you know, part of Jessica's, you know, question there.
Does he now get angry at them? Because
that was exactly Jessica's question. George, take search number 11. This is Yechezkel 16:59-63 on page 4.
Ezekiel?
Yeah.
The Lord and King says, I will punish you in keeping with what you have done. I sealed the covenant I made with you. You hated that oath, and you broke my covenant. But I will remember my covenant with you. I made it with you when you were young. Now I will make a new covenant with you. It will last forever. Then you will remember how you have lived. You will be ashamed when I give you the you Samaria and Sodom. Samaria is your older sister, Sodom is your younger one. I will give them and their daughters to you as daughters. You can't happen based on my old covenant with you. So I will make a new covenant with you. Then you will know that I am the Lord. I will pay for all of the sins that you have committed. Then you will remember that you have done what you have done. You will be ashamed of it because of your shame. You will never speak again against me again. Pronounce the king and the Lord and the king.
Right. So you may remember from last week, we also had another. I don't like the translation here of a new covenant. Deshakimoti et briti. It doesn't use that term hadashah like we saw last week in Yirmiyahu about a new covenant. Whereas that covenant was God would imprint the Torah on your hearts and you wouldn't have to worry about it. Now it seems to be, you know, the main themes here are one, lahafer brit. We have that idiom again that we broke the covenant. Two, despite the fact that we broke the covenant, Zecharti ani et briti, God still remembers the covenant, which means even if we don't keep up our end of the bargain, God is still going to remember it. Now here it says God's going to uphold it, Hakimoti lecha brit olam, of keeping up some internal covenant, and I put this under the section tough love because the point of this new covenant is basically to make us feel guilty about what we've done in the past. All right? It's like, yeah, so like, oh, yeah.
Is this when Ezekiel was in Babylon or when he's returned to Israel?
This is, still, I believe, still in Babylon. or at least after.
Why does he talk about
some? All right, actually, one second. Let me. These are rather idioms made of, you know, some type associating you with other sinners. And what this new covenant will do is basically say, you know, put you in that, you know, other state. From the purposes that, you know, of our main premise today about chosenness, you know, we broke the covenant, but God's still holding up. In, you know, source number 11 here from Ezekiel 16, it's not necessarily to our benefit, but that we're, you know, that was why we get to section 5.
I don't understand Samaria and Sodom. I mean, I understand that, you know, they don't exist anymore, so they're being used as a metaphor somehow, but what does it mean to say, you know, you're having their daughters, and he's in your, what does it mean for God to give them Israel, Samaria, and Sodom?
Good question. I would guess, my guess would be it would have to, whatchamacallit, it would have to do, let me just double check the language here. Yeah, I'm not sure about that translation there, actually, because it's not actually in the verse itself. I mean, it could be references to, I mean, could very well be references made to, you know, passages that I had omitted here. You know, could also refer to like Ammon and Moab, say for Stone, you know, in terms of like daughters and merging, but that gets a little more complicated.
It sounds like, yeah, because it sounds like it's about intermarriage, which doesn't really the rest of it.
Well, yeah, but, you know, for that we'd have to look at the chapter as a whole to really, you know, get that metaphor. Moving on, Yeshayahu 14, source number 12. Take it. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Lord will show tender love towards Jacob's people. Once again, he will choose Israel. He'll still sell them in their own land. Outsiders will join them. They and the people of Jacob will become one people. Nations will help Israel return to their own land. People from other nations will belong to Israel. So Israel, they will serve them as male and female servants in the Lord's land. Israelites will make prisoners over those who had held them as prisoners. They will rule over those who had crushed them.
Yeah. So the underline here is Uvachar Oz Yisrael. God will eventually choose Israel again in the future,
yes, yeah.
Which is a fairly important statement. And taking this at face value, it means even though we may have rejected God, that doesn't mean God has permanently rejected us. Ed, take number 13. This is Yeshayahu 43.
Family of Jacob, the Lord created you. People of Israel, he formed you. He says, do not be afraid. I will set you free. I will send for you by name. You belong to me. You will pass through deep waters, but I will be with you. You will pass through the rivers, but the waters will not sweep over you. You will walk through fire, but you will not be burned. The flames will not harm you. I am the Lord your God. I am the Holy One of Israel. I am the one who saves you. I will give up Egypt to set you free. I will give up Cush and Seba. For you, you are priceless to me. I love you and honor you.
Yeah. So I underline in the Hebrew, you have a reiteration of li'ata. We are still possessed by God. You are priceless to me. I love and I honor you. Which, you know, is not something you would assume if there was a permanent rejection. And for the clincher, one second, you know, the coup de grace, Yirmiyahu 33. Right, God tell message came from to me from the Lord. Call Amar Hashem. This is what God says: Im taferu et briti hayom vet briti halayla uvilti hayot yomam halayla biitam. Could you ever break my covenant with the day? Could you ever break my covenant with the night? Gam briti tefar et David avdim hayot lo then molech al kisao that telavim kadim esharati. Could you, could you ever stop the day and night from coming through appointed times? Only then could my covenant with my servant David be broken. Only then could my covenant with the Levites who serve me as priests be broken. Only then would David no longer have someone in his family line to roll on his throne. Right, and it continues, here's what I'll do for my servant David, et cetera, make them stars of the sky. Now, this is, a real, especially coming from Yirmiyahu, who is prophesizing over the actual destruction of the temple, a huge, huge statement. Mm-hmm. And if anything, it's a reiteration of that point, you know, that tried to, you know, get today, is that, assuming that we were chosen by God because of a covenant, even though there are numerous statements that we've seen about us being neferet briti, of us breaking the covenant in terms of not keeping up our end of the bargain, idioms of us leaving God as avuat Hashem, God is still keeping up his end of the bargain too, and is still reiterating that fact that even the covenant that we made that was conditional in the sense that we had to do something for it, even if we don't hold up our end, that covenant has still not been annulled, or at least not annulled completely. Yeah.
Go back to Isaiah 43. God says, I will give up Egypt to set you free. I will give up Cush and Seba. Did he have them? What does that mean in terms of he have a covenant with them?
In terms of Moshiach and Etati Chofrecha, it really means it's not like give them, it's not give up, Netati Chofrecha Mitzrayim. It means giving them under you, in a sense that you're going to have dominion over them. This is why we include the Hebrew, because the English translations, I think I'm using the New International Version because it's the easiest one I can find that I can copy and paste. But it's not ideal, which is why, you know, having the original on the side is helpful. Idiomatically, I don't think it means you give them up as much as they that may seem as the national powers at this time, you are going to have dominion over them, and it will be God's intervention that will do that. Which also goes back to that question about choosing another nation in your stead. Right? Any thoughts on this so far? Well, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more skeptical that these days. It's impossible to prove that God is giving up a nation to us, and that's why we're triumphing over it. He makes the statement, we may triumph over it, but to prove the causal connection, we have to take his word for it.
So that is a great question that, you know, we'll, you'll start getting to in subsequent weeks. We're focusing first on the biblical sources of it, in terms of what do we know, you know, from God, or at least in the limited context of, you know, God and the Jewish people in the desert, God and Israel up until the exile. When you start getting to, you know, the rabbinic period and the voice of God speaking directly doesn't come into play as much, you have a lot more of an interpretive tradition in terms of, well, how do you read at certain events? What we're doing here is, at least, you know, in the first couple of weeks of focusing on the biblical side, is laying the groundwork for subsequent discussions. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you know, there are a few biblical premises without which any subsequent discussion won't make sense. One is, you know, what is the biblical evidence that Jews might have for being considered the chosen people? You know, we spent a couple, you know, 2 weeks on that. And today, saying, well, did we in fact reject the covenant? Is it a breakable covenant? And from today, the intent or the main point is to show that at least one covenant is enduring. And our status as being chosen by God seems to be permanent no matter what we do. That yes, we could get punished by God for a whole lot of things, but that in no way it negates the relationship that we have with God. It might manifest somewhat differently, and you may find people, you know, that will read today God into different things based on this, you know, level of chosenness that I will concede is entirely speculative. There's a certain, you know, in terms of things that we assume on faith, and I know this is more of a discussion for our fundamentals class, you know, we're going to take, I think Moshe's will take the words of the prophet as, you know, a sign of, you know, we have a tradition that there was prophecy, God spoke to certain people, and these people spoke in God's name. Today, at least, you know, in rabbinic sources, you know, says all prophecy ended at a certain point. So today, anyone who claims to speak in God's name, even following the rabbinic tradition of Judaism, you have every right to be skeptical. I mean, people might find certain things in the patterns, and people may say, oh, someone's maybe more attached or more attuned. But to my knowledge, I mean, based on the rabbinic tradition, at least, you know, you don't have prophecy. And that's a whole separate other discussion. You know, there's another source that says prophecy is given to children and stupid people. You know, if anyone gets up and claims, God told me X, you know, yeah, that's a good reason to be skeptical. And the truth is, I also personally get annoyed when I hear other colleagues that say definitively, here is God's plan of why something happened. At best, you can read certain texts in certain ways, but no one gets appointed, to my knowledge, no one's been appointed as like, you're now speaking on God's behalf. And I, you know, in my own speech, I try to, you know, be nuanced enough to say, well, here's what I think is going on, as opposed to saying with any absolute certainty, here's what God means, because I, you know, don't know for certain. I could have a guess, I could have certain thoughts, you know, but is it objectively better than others? You know, as you said, there's absolutely no way to tell. You know, Rambam, when he writes about, you know, how do you tell a prophet is a false prophet or a real one? And it's, well, if he tells you something is going to happen and it comes true, right? But if I'm going to say, oh, something's going to happen in 100 years, you know, and it's like, hey, sure, you know, just wait for it. And you have the, I'm forgetting the guy's name, who predicted the end of the world twice this year so far and has since been wrong. Yeah, the first time it was supposed to end was in May, then he said he did a math error. And it was supposed to be a couple of weeks ago, and lo and behold, we're still here. Right. So in terms of our sense with chosenness, right, so for the first couple of weeks, we do have a contract with God. It does appear to be permanent, such that we can't actually break it, which means for, you know, taking all of Nach as, you know, some sort of a collective unit, which I concede is difficult because there's a lot of information in Tanakh. There does not, to my mind, seem to be any indication of God rejecting the Jewish people, at least in a permanent sense that we would define it as, no longer being God's chosen people. In fact, we have explicit sources here reiterating God's chosenness of the Jewish people and reaffirming a covenant of some sort. Right. So if you take one or two verses, and it is kind of important, like why I tried to throw in a sort of range here, because it is easy to find like one verse in or out of context and hold that up and say, oh, you see, we turned away from God and therefore God's rejected us. But you don't find that logical statement made, or at least not supported enough based on enough contradictory material of God saying, yes, just as, you know, you can't break the covenant with the day and the night, I'm not going to break my covenant with David and the Levium. Like, that's, you know, kind of reminding us that no matter how hard we try, you know, the real covenant is still going to be in effect and in force.
In fact, that's really essential, I think, for the whole, all the Tanakh, because the whole agenda of the prophets, certainly the prophets, is to say, basically, you know, if you turn back to God, things will be better.
Mm.
So if you said the covenant was broken, that would kind of destroy the whole argument.
Right. And I think one reason why it can work this way is, you know, twofold. One, of the two main covenants that designate Jews as chosen people is the covenant with Abraham that was given with no strings attached, no conditions at all. It was Doratam Brit Olam. It was a permanent covenant with Abraham that his seed will have some special status. And the other is, based on the structure of the covenants at Har Sinai and the others, the consequences of not doing what God says isn't the complete nullification of the covenant, but rather we would be liable for damages in the form of various punishments. All right?
How do you, Catholicism, other forms of Christianity, view
that? Take it up with them. That's the best answer I can have. And next week, I know we started introducing the idea, you know, a few weeks ago, but it's important to explain the nature of the covenant. Next week, we're going to deal with biblical sources indicating, well, now that we are God's chosen people, focus more on what really makes us different, specific laws that would, in fact, set us apart. Maybe we can find some recurring themes there. Maybe not. And then after that, we'll focus on to the rabbinic period, and we'll stay a long time there, because in the rabbinic period, we have, you know, not only rabbinic textual commentary on many of these verses and the covenants and the accepting of the covenants and what those things were like, but also in terms of halachot, about how we as a Jewish people are supposed to be, or which ways we're supposed to be distinct from our neighbors. And, you know, and what are the halachot regarding how Jews relate to non-Jews at all. So we'll spend a lot of time there. All right? Have a wonderful week.